idea.
Okay, I think we'll get started. There might still be a couple of people drifting in, I suppose, but we can make a start. Okay. So, welcome everyone. I'm Christy Siegfried. I'm moderating the session. I'm the migration editor with IRIN News, which hopefully you've heard of. It's a humanitarian news service. We do a lot of refugee and migration coverage, and I'm based here in the UK managing all that. So we're going to be talking about countering stigma in the media. And with us we've got Caroline Gregory, who's a journalist and an editor, and also very active volunteering in Calais. And we've got Hazel Healy, who's co-editor of The New Internationalist and a campaigner for migrant justice. Yep, and she edited a great issue recently on migration. And we've got Almami Tal, who's a human rights advocate and an investigative journalist. He's also working with Hope Projects, which is a NGO supporting asylum seekers and refugees in Birmingham. So I'll get things started. So last year, as we all know, was really the year that Europe was forced to wake up to the refugee crisis that had already been playing out in many other parts of the world for a long time. Suddenly, the media in Europe had easy access to all these dramatic images and stories. And in some ways, I think it presented a big opportunity for the media to really go into greater depth in some of the issues around refugees, which had previously been, you know, out there, playing out in the Middle East and Africa, and had received quite superficial coverage, I think, in Europe. And now, if you were a journalist last year, you could just get a cheap flight to Greece, and suddenly you could be witnessing boats coming ashore and interviewing people and hearing their stories. And I think it made it more difficult to rely on the usual stereotypes and assumptions about asylum seekers. Those arriving in Greece were mostly Syrians fleeing war. They were mainly middle class, well-dressed. I think it really put more of a human face to something which had always been, oh, it's, you know, it's out there in Africa or the Middle East. Suddenly there was a debate about how we should be referring to these people. Are they migrants? Are they refugees? Are they both? I don't think we'd really had that debate before, so I think that was positive. And then, of course, the real watershed moment was the photo of Alan Kurdi on the beach. And that was the point when even some newspapers like The Sun and the Daily Mail sensed this shift in public opinion and started responding with more sympathetic headlines. Unfortunately, that was quite short-lived. The tide quickly turned again after the Paris attacks. And I was just Googling some headlines yesterday, and I came across one from the Daily Mail, which was, I'll read it out to you. Stunned holidaymakers film 20 men jumping out of packed rubber boat on the Costa del Sol and scampering away. But were they migrants or terrorists? And it's this really short story about this tourist who's on his balcony of his hotel filming these guys just running off from the beach.
And they met on a stag do. Lost their way.
There's no word from the migrants or the refugees. It's all from the point of view of these shocked British tourists. And then we have another recent headline from The Sun. Murdered couple's daughter. We let migrants in. They burgle and kill us. And this was about a couple that were killed in the Italian countryside, and the accused is an 18-year-old asylum seeker from the Ivory Coast. And we've got a quote from the daughter saying, they let these migrants come here and they do what they want, including burgling and killing. And so I guess my question to the panellists is, how much has really changed in the last year? How far have we really come? Has the media learned anything? Or are we sort of back to where we started, especially in light of some of the coverage that we're getting around the EU referendum. So I'll hand over to Caroline.
Thank you. As has been said, I'm editor and journalist, and also for a year now I've been based mostly on the ground in Calais and Dunkirk, so naturally my focus is very much on the media surrounding that particular situation. I've been sort of moving between being a journalist and being just a normal volunteer, and I've also ended up being very much the PR and media representative over there, so I tend to be the one that journalists get connected with, some of them, and then I'm able to sort of guide them and hopefully direct them to a certain extent in their time over there, which has been an interesting experience. I fully agree, as was said in the last session, that the press agenda has been very one-sided in all of this. It's not in sync with public feeling, public opinion, and unfortunately politicians themselves get their narratives, their ideas from the media, just like most people do. So I think one of the issues, I've met a lot of politicians over there in this past year, and they say things, when we were trying to push for the Dubs Amendment to go through about unaccompanied children in Calais, one of the main things that politicians said to me is, oh, there's nowhere for the children to go, there's no one who will foster these children or look after them. And I said, you know, I know of charities, I've got thousands of people on lists that will do this, but because it's not being reported by the media, that doesn't filter through to politicians either. So the media narrative is absolutely key in what happens even at governmental levels. I think the importance of it can't be underestimated. I've become very aware that the choice of terms that are used within the media is absolutely key. We've already mentioned about the migrant, immigrant, economic migrant, refugee issue, and that's very important because those, whether we like it or not, I mean, I don't have a problem with people being economic migrants. If I was born into a country where I had no prospects for work, then I'd move to a country where I did. However, in the public perception, there is a difference. And so to a certain extent, we have to be aware of that in what people are referred to as. A couple of weeks ago, Channel 4 News, Porrick O'Brien did a report on all the Albanians in the Calais jungle. Now, we do a census every month with some great methodology behind it, and there are no Albanians in the Calais jungle. Now, why is this important? Well, it's important for two reasons. It's important, obviously, in terms of truth. Journalism is nothing if not seeking after truth, hopefully. But it's also important for a second reason, in that people in the UK would say Albania is not a war-torn country. People coming from Albania have rights that perhaps people from Syria don't have. So it is important to recognise that and to be aware that by implying the Calais jungle was only full of Albanians and Albanian smuggler networks, that was playing into a rhetoric that says these people are not genuine refugees. And Porrick O'Brien was actually brilliant. I tweeted him, I got a response from him, and we've been in conversation since. So, you know, kudos to Channel 4 for actually correcting themselves on that one. But it's important to stay on top of all these sorts of things. I think another example of how the terms that are used in the media are so important is that in so many of the reports about Calais and Dunkirk, the volunteers have been described as activists and activists and anarchists. Now, again, I don't have a problem with the term activist. I'm sure many of us would class ourselves as activists. However, in terms of politicians and perception as a whole, calling someone an activist means you can dismiss everything they say. They are conspiracy theorists, they make a lot of stuff up. And it's also, again, it's not true. There's only ever been a handful of activists in Calais and Dunkirk, and the No Borders activists. However, there have been now 10,000 British volunteers over there, 10,000 individual volunteers, and they are lawyers, engineers, doctors, teachers, normal professionals. Now, you know, it's inaccurate, and it plays into this rhetoric around the fact that it's no one who can be relied on. There are no reliable sources reporting from the Calais jungle and from Dunkirk, which is inaccurate. Whether we like the fact that activist tends to mean that thing, that to the public or not. I think that also gives the media certain, and the media and politicians, a certain amount of plausible deniability, because they can say, well, we had no reliable sources. We didn't know that there are currently 544 unaccompanied children in Calais, which there are. because the only people who were saying that were activists and we didn't believe them. So it's very important, I think, that the correct terms are used for these things, you know, even aside from seeking the truth, which I hope we would all want to do. And related to this is the lack of understanding and willingness on the part of a lot of media to accept information from the organisations on the ground. Now, there is no point in journalists ringing UNICEF or Save the Children or, dare I say it, the Red Cross about Calais and Dunkirk, because they're not there. The organisations that are there are small organisations, quite grassroots organisations that are newer. And because of that, they are not seen as legitimate sources, even though it is professionals running those charities. So that's another situation where I think there's a certain amount of journalism laziness in terms of that. I mean, it only takes a couple of Google clicks to find out which organisations are actually there and to find out who represents the media, to find my name as a media representative there. But the media doesn't do that. They take the shortcut and just phone a big charity because that gives a certain amount of legitimacy to a quote, even though actually it doesn't, because those organisations aren't there and they can't tell you what's happening day to day on the ground. I don't know how much more time I have, but I think another battle that we face is that classic one of the media and perhaps its readership being so keen on only presenting bad, dramatic news, melodramatic news. This is a big problem. For one example, when the Paris attacks happened, the Daily Mail the next day had the headlines. It was along the lines of jihadis snuck into Europe as fake refugees, something like this. Now, that same night in the Calais camp, we had held a vigil for the victims of the Paris attacks because the people in the Calais and Dunkirk camps are fleeing from ISIS. They are not ISIS. They are not terrorists. They are fleeing from the same terrorists that the Daily Mail would say they are. But of course, despite us passing out this good news story about the vigil to, as all round, all the mainstream media and smaller media as well, no one will pick it up. No one is interested in running the good news story, only the bad news stories. And for that reason, I think as was said in the last session as well, the populist media, the online media, has been our friend to a great extent. It's things like BuzzFeed, Vice, Mashable and so on that are willing to run more upbeat stories on the situation. Just to very briefly answer the question, how can the media help? Well, seeking truth, as always, is key and should be the number one aim. Seeking truth above twisting things into a good story. It has to be this seeking after the actual real facts. And I think us journalists can be quite an arrogant bunch. We've had lots of examples in Calais and Dunkirk of journalists being deeply unethical. There's no safeguarding there. So we've had journalists sort of grabbing lots of the children who are by themselves and having pictures taken with them and posing them into pictures. You know, that would be illegal 20 miles away here in Britain, but because there's no safeguarding there in the camps, they get away with it. So I think my final message to anyone interested in reporting would be, don't become part of the problem in pursuit of a good story.
Thank you, Carol. That was really interesting to get the perspective from Calais. Thank you. We are going to have time for questions at the end. I've just asked the speakers to kick things off. So, Hazel, over to you.
Okay. So, I've thought a lot about these issues over the years. I used to work for an NGO, or help run a refugee advocacy organisation in Manchester, where we help communities set up their own organisations. And that was in around 2007, 2008. And that was at a time when you were getting articles like the Swan Bake. Do you remember that in the Sunday Express? Completely fabricated story that asylum seekers were catching and roasting swans and eating them in public parks. There was a complaint. It became sort of iconic story because it was. I mean, there were a number of stories fabricated, but this was kind of the worst, one of the worst, or one of the ones that became most famous. And it was a very hostile time. It felt to be working in that area, and now it does actually feel different. And although I think there's the media's been quite schizophrenic. Like, yes, there was this big response to Aaron Kurdi, and I also remember reading an article in the Daily Mail perhaps a few days after that said, why do mothers risk their children's life at sea? And I was like, what's it going to say? And then it had this list of profiles, amazing in-depth profiles of Iraqis, Afghanis, not even any Syrians on the list, talking about why they'd had to leave, what their worries were, that they were doing secondary migration, but they didn't accuse them of being economic migrants, that they hadn't been able to build viable lives in other cities in Iraq. It was a very sympathetic, in-depth piece. I couldn't believe it. So obviously these things don't necessarily stay the distance, but I think what has is that the response, and this is what Caroline says about 10,000 volunteers in Calais, like in terms of what the empathy that photo was, like a tipping point for so many people. So when I was in Lesbos in November researching this magazine, you know, the volunteers who I met there again weren't like your classic activists. It was like a grown-up mother, single mother of four children, who was there, a Danish scientist who was on a career break. You know, it's just like people who'd seen the photo and gone, this can't happen, you know, this has got to stop, this is too much, the children are drowning. They were doing really important work. They were getting people off boats, stopping them from catching hypothermia, making sure they had enough provisions to carry on their journey, looking out for boats at night. So in some cases, you know, people go from ignorance, there's this journey, ignorance, passive sympathy, active support, and I think it really jumped people actually straight from ignorance to active support. Is quite extraordinary, the impact. So that just shows the impact that a piece of media can have, you know. So I guess it's the point that the media can be used for good or bad, you know. It can be a force for change and a force for negativity as well. I'll just mention, I think they said the refugee crisis is, they think it's the most photographed event of all time. You know, that's the amount of interest that it has generated. And I think the other reason there's been more sympathy now, say, compared to when I was doing this working with asylum seekers in 2007, is there's been so much background on the war in Syria that at least for that group, people, actually the general public, have a good sense of why you might want to leave Syria. You know, I think that does help people have a more sympathetic understanding of the background. And in terms of the power, like how important is media public perception? What damage can it do? I mean, I think everyone in this room probably knows this, but I won't talk about it for long, but I think, you know, it can deepen community divisions. And I think particularly people with no other reference points are very vulnerable. So my partner's grandmother, who lives in a very small village in North Yorkshire, doesn't know anyone from any other places, but she reads the Daily Mail every day. You know, you just... She's got nothing else to go on, you know, and she just repeats it. And the studies that show that the people who are actually most hostile to foreign-born people are the people who don't have any living in their area, and I think that just says it all. And I think those people in particular who don't have the personal experience of mixing with people from other countries to realise that they're actually just a little bit like you, perhaps a lot like you, are the ones who really can be led astray by this sort of nasty, irresponsible and often untrue reporting. There's obviously been low points with the press, the Katie Hopkins, cockroaches, and things. She's the Sun reporter who wrote about migrants as cockroaches and was pulled up that was in April 2015, pulled up by the UN human rights chief as being comparable to Nazi propaganda. I think it's worth saying as well that provokes 300,000 online protests. I think it's something that people are, you know, pushed back strongly against when things like that happen. And then, in terms of, I often wonder with this subject, like, who is the tail wagging the dog, or is the dog wagging the tail? Is it the politicians? Is it the media? Who's influencing who? Is it the genuine public fears? Are they actually created by the media? And I think it just depends. Public perceptions are, you know, they're not a static thing, they change, and people's reference points will change. So people who were perhaps, their baseline was to be suspicious and not very sympathetic to refugees, maybe due to have clearly from the humanitarian crisis actually begun to review that, and actually maybe they're a bit more sympathetic now. So, and perhaps the media's pushing a line that, like you were saying, isn't actually in step with what ordinary people feel, and then that's actually a massive missed opportunity from politicians. So there was a report by the Norwegian Refugee Council that reviewed the impact of the media in 15 different countries and some countries outside the EU. And one of the things that they said the report on the UK was that hate speech in this country was generated less from outside than from within. So say in places like Bulgaria, all the politicians are just spewing out hate speech all the time and the media is irresponsibly reproducing it. But in this country, they suggested it was actually more the other way around, but it was the media that was pushing the positive. But I just don't know if that's giving them a little bit too much credit. I mean, I think, politicians, I mean.
Okay.
Because I think they make a lot of political capital out of this, and that blaming migrants for everything is a way to distract from the things, the real reasons that people might be unhappy with: insecure housing or poorly paid jobs or insecure work and prospects. So I think it's also quite convenient for the politicians to have a group to scapegoat and distract from what might be the real causes. So they have a big vested interest there. I think different countries, different moments, different the media or politicians are to blame, in my view. I've got a few points quickly, but I don't want to talk too long. In terms of how to be more inclusive, I think you need to have articles that have history, that bring in experts, that bring in people like Adnan Betts, who can show with evidence that this crisis is one of politics, not one of numbers, that can show how crises like this were dealt with in the past, that can show how they were dealt with in other countries, to make the point again and again that most people aren't even anywhere near Europe, and the majority of them are in developing countries that have much less resources to look after them. I mean, that's, everyone in this room knows that, but how many, it just gets lost to repeat these things. And bringing voices like Hinda Haas, who's this academic whose work shows, he's looked at, I don't know, slightly make up these numbers, but many countries, 145 countries over 45 years, amazing scan of his work statistically, and he looks at when borders were introduced and actually how they've driven migration, and now or never migration. And these are actually statistically proven, or just the basic fact that until 1992, you didn't need a visa to get to Spain or Italy from North Africa. And it's like, oh, no, that can't be right. Surely they'd be overrun. No, they weren't. You could just go there and work and go home again. So these ideas that help people give a broader picture and put all this fear around migration and around refugees and asylum seekers in a much broader context of what's happening in the world and why. And so journalists have a responsibility to do that, provide that broader lens. And I think you also need to find the right tone. So again, like you say, not just all the bad news, but also when I was in Lesbos, I witnessed terrible tragedies and the people, the drought, losing children on journeys, and that was part of the story. But the other part of the story was like this amazing superhighway of humanity in this Greek island, buying sandwiches from a Greek sort of kiosk on the GNC, and there were Somalis and Afghans and Burmese and just people from all over the world moving and deciding, making their own decision about where they wanted to be and where they wanted to live. And there was a certain something to be celebrated there about, this is, you get a bit cliched when you talk about it was determination or resilience, but it's actually quite an amazing phenomenon, and you should recognise it as such, not just see it as a terribly bad thing. Let's actually celebrate the people who are making this thing happen, who are sort of denying the borders in a way and saying we'll decide where we want to go. And I'll just say, just in terms of voices, how we bring refugee voices into the media, that was something else we were asked to mention. There's a very good example in Denmark of a newspaper that gave over all their pages just to Syrian journalists for a day. So things like that, initiatives like that, where they people, and that would have taken a lot of time and research to do that and translate all those from Arabic and see what subjects they wanted to write about. And surprise, surprise, they didn't want to write about migration, they wanted to write about the people who were left behind and what was happening to them. There are also really good initiatives by people like Detention Action, who have a Freed Voices group, who are trained spokespeople who can represent their community of people who've been through detention, and they're ready to speak, and they've got good quotes, and they make it easy for journalists to, you know, just pick up that perspective in first person. I'll stop there.
Okay, thanks, Kate.
Okay. Right, thank you. Difficult to do better after Catherine and Hazard, but I'll try. I will focus my interventions on 2 points. One is talking about the stigma, and the second one is how to counter that stigma. But before then, I would like to answer Christy's questions and give you a little bit of background to understand where I'm coming from. How much has really changed? I would say not much. Not much in terms of the same things happening. You remember when Enoch Powell was talking about river of blood, that was a long time ago, and we passed through the immigration rules, changing the law, and removing the right to work from asylum seekers. And then since the 9/11, a lot of things change, and we talk about terrorism, and we introduce a lot of law just based on that risk, that perceptions of risk to the country, risk to communities, and people really kind of sat back and did nothing, because it's a natural process for people to, when they fear about something, it's a natural instinct to let things go for their thinking, is for their own protection. What we do see in the media is all a combined factor. It's not one. If you break it down and try to deal with it in an isolated way, it wouldn't be possible. It's a combined factor. You have the politicians on one side, you have as well, I would call them not really journalists, because there's a difference between giving accurate information and also entertaining people and or seeking to celebrity to be famous. I will touch that later. I graduated in Europe, from European universities, and specialized in journalism before going back to Africa and work as an investigative journalist for over 10 years. That might shock some people to say, oh, how could that be possible? It looks too young. I'm 53 years old.
Oh my goodness.
Okay. I spend most of my time covering really things you would never imagine, and I don't wish anybody to experience those things, to witness those things. I've been in many hot pots around the globe during the worst period of their times, civil war in Sierra Leone, civil war in Liberia. I've been to Sudan, I've been to Libya, I've been recently to Turkey, I've been to Lampedusa. I witnessed a lot of things, but usually the reality is not what you see on the TV, it's not what you watch, it's not what you read on newspapers or tabloids, it's not what you hear from the radio, completely different. People are most of the times misled and they get confused and thinking that, oh my God, this is true, this is not. Reality is not like black and white. And I always tell, when I go to universities talking to students and also, I said, the first question you should always ask is why. Because when you ask why, it forces the other person in front of you to dig deeper and to explain the reasons. And more you ask why, more you get to know. And more you have to have a critical mind, not just to believe on one side what you see, but try to ask yourself as well, is that true? How could that be possible? And so I will touch that as well later on. So, when you talk about the media, what we do see, news and futures articles on asylum rely heavily on politicians. That's the fact. Individual asylum seekers And refugees are only quoted when they themselves are the subject of a report and rarely contribute directly to the policy debate. This is an article from ICART in 2003, but there's a reason why asylum seekers and refugees don't really contribute to the political debate. What most people don't understand, and is when you're born in Europe, brought up in Europe, you were born in an environment where you think everything is democracy, everything is all right. It becomes difficult for you to comprehend certain things happening outside Europe. And let me give you a typical example. You see one asylum seeker or refugee on TV raising some serious concerns or exposing some atrocity committed by one authority, one personality of this country. That person is here, seems to be safe, but by retaliation, that person's family over there, that person's relatives over there, that person's friends over there might be arrested, tortured, and get killed because of the one person here says about the authority of the country. So that is one of the things people don't understand. I've seen it a lot. I've seen somebody, a comedian, some people here, you can see them on TV making jokes of the Queen or the Prime Minister. People will laugh. Next day, you will see that person walking on the street. Nobody will bother that person. Somebody in one African country is a comedian. Made a silly joke, just a bit funny, about one president of a country, African country. He was not going there, but later on, way later on, he traveled to that country. That president with the massive ego was waiting for him. Once he crossed the border, he got arrested. He got beaten, seriously beaten, because of a joke he made many months ago. Could you imagine that in Europe? Could you imagine recently in Ethiopia, the Omoro tribe, because the Ethiopian government want to expand the capital, and the Omoro tribe, they have their own the lands around. They want to push them to displace them. They were peacefully demonstrating on the street. 400 of them got killed, shot in broad daylight. Thousands wounded. You don't see that on the media. Have you seen it anywhere? Those are kind of things. There are more people who die by trying to cross the desert than people who die in the Mediterranean. But you don't see that on the media. I walk on the desert to see women having their children who were dead with their children on their chest. You can't see that in the media. I'm not interested in having my names on the media. What I'm interested in is investigating, gathering all the evidence and pass it on. There are a lot of things happening in this world that people are not aware about. There are many big institutions who are supposed to protect the people's rights, who are supposed to do the right thing, who are supposed to advocate for people, and there are members of those institutions doing the wrong thing. I investigate corruptions within the UNHCR department, and there is a massive investigation at higher level going on. I gave the paper, all the evidence to them. I investigate certain things. People being raped by UN peacekeepers. You don't see them in the media. But this is happening. The problem I have with my colleague journalists, I'm from an older school. I'm not interested in political positions. I'm not interested in being famous. What I'm interested in serving people, being truthful, being accurate when I do my investigation. But what is happening is a lot of things influence journalists. They may be pro-left or pro-right. They may be centrist. They may be having some homophobic feelings inside. And they use their opinions when they write articles. It's okay for them to make comments and say, I'm making a comment. That's fine. But it's not okay when you are writing things to use your own feeling and to use your own opinions by distorting the fact and misleading people. And that's what happens in the media. And refugees should be protected as well from that abuse from the media. Long time ago, I spent a couple of years working with a reputable organization as a media watchdog, to scrutinize the media, what's being published, and what's being televisions, tabloids, newspaper, radio. What they do is to file hundreds and hundreds of complaints to the PCC, the Press Commission complaint. And what would result out of it? The media would apologize with one sentence saying they apologize. The damage is already done. Because people who read it might not read the apology. Or even if they read the apology, they would not really assimilate the apology to the mistakes that have been created. And my grandfather used to tell me, words, and when you write something, these things are like bullets fired from a gun. Once it's done, once it's said, well, you cannot catch it back. But the bullet fired on somebody, you receive the bullet, the damage is done. If I say sorry to you, you may be paralyzed for life. You may be wounded for life. You may be psychologically as well, being wounded for life. We need to think carefully about things we say. We need to think carefully about things we write before publishing them or before saying them. Because the other people at the receiving end would feel much worse or much better. By simple, you just say somebody, oh, you're beautiful. It's wonderful. But even if you're beautiful, you're the miss of this world, and I look at you and say, you're ugly, you feel bad. You get angry. So those are things that we use in the media and to distort information. We have the unbalanced media coverage and public debate. Very rarely, exceptionally, you see an asylum seeker or a refugee invited to sit around the table and to have equal opportunity to voice what they have to voice out and to protect what they have to protect. It's usually other people sitting around the table talking on their behalf or trying to defend them or to accuse them. That is unbalanced. I emailed Dembeldi, Question Town, etc. I don't understand why when we talk about refugees, asylum seekers, migrants, you don't have any of them at the panel to face questions. Why people should be sitting around the table talking on their behalf, and there may be few of them are part of the audience, and if they are lucky enough, they will have one question. But a question is different to somebody facing a barrage of questions and defending themselves. That's different. So we need to advocate for a fair balance reporting at major debates. We need to empower asylum seekers and refugees, and we need to do it in a balanced way. There are consent forms that people should sign when they are interviewed, but sometimes journalists just take, and what they get, what they want, they wouldn't really pay attention to the consequences. So these are people that stop asylum seekers and refugees from facing the media, because it's a matter of trust as well. If that level of trust is not there, somebody is just coming to take and go away, use it anyhow, without any concerns of any consequences related to that, people will fear to continue talking to you or to do anything with you. But to counter the stigma, it's really important that we stop discriminating as well. For example, we mentioned it early debate. We talk about Daily Mail, Daily Express. Oh, well, these people, they are on the other side. Don't get close to them. That's not the right thing to do. They are human beings like us. They have different ideas for whatever reasons. They believe in different things or they think differently, but that's how society works. You need to welcome differences. If you're not ready to welcome somebody facing you and shouting at you and you don't take that stick, you will not make major change, sustainable change. You cannot isolate people. You cannot put them in a bubble. Ourselves, we do things with people we like and with people we think they are the one who have the same ideas, who want to do the same thing. We don't include other people we perceive as enemies. Nobody is an enemy. None of them. They are all human beings having different ideas, different perceptions, different ideology. Even the worst criminal giving a second chance to meet with somebody who peacefully, lovingly, caring, that attitude might change that person's perception. Nobody is 100% bad. It's bad for some people, but some people will think this is the best person for us. So we need not to put people in basket, to label them, and to live in bubble. We need to open up. We need to accept to take the responsibility. When a colleague journalist does something that is not really in line with the journalism ethics, not to complain officially about it, because if you complain, you're pushing that person to face the world. And one person has no options, the person will attack you, continue to attack you. But if you change tactic, we change strategy, and show that person, okay, your article did a lot of damage to these people. These are the facts, the result of your articles. Do you honestly think that this is the way to do your job? We call everybody journalist. Anybody who writes a piece of paper is called journalist. You go to radio, DJs, and everybody, the journalist. But the profession is not like that. There are people, even if they got degree in journalism, but they kind of work in an entertainment environment. They seek to interest or to impress certain category of people. And if you isolate them, we are not making any change. We are not getting what we want, the positive result. We are not getting the way of people should live together. Whether it's about Syrians, now the opinion poll is divided. Now even among self we are divided. People are getting angry because we talk more about Syrians than Eritreans, Ethiopians. Now you see Eritrean, Ethiopian is a kind of the same things that politicians been used since the beginning of this herd, is divide and rule. And we are buying this kind of rhetoric and we are accepting to be divided and rule. You talk to Zimbabwe and you say, okay, I don't want to do anything with Congolese. You go talk to Congolese, they will tell you the same thing. You talk to Afghan, they said, or Syrians. Now even people, we accept to play this game. We don't use our common sense. We don't use our critical mind to open up and to embrace differences and to be together. That's the same thing with communication. It's a powerful tool, you said it earlier. Every single thing has two sides. One is negative and one is positive. You can use communication to do a lot of good, to achieve lots of positive things. Right? The same way, you can use it to make a lot of damages. So we need to find the balance. And how to find the balance is to help them to understand and to change their perception. It's not to isolate them. It's also giving voice to refugees. There are alternatives. Significant progress because of social media. you can use social media. There is no control. You don't need to go to Daily Mail, Daily Express, Telegraph thing. You can use social media. You can do blogging. You can use Facebook, Twitter, whatever you want. You can post pictures. You can make comments on this. You can take one thing, what the Arab Spring. The world been aware of the Arab Spring because of social media. And a lot of things happening in this world. You take picture, next minute, the whole world will know about it. It travels across the world without any boundaries. We need to encourage people as well to use social media. We need as well other alternative is face-to-face for refugees and asylum seekers to be empowered and giving the training needs. They have skills, but a lot of things undermine them. They don't feel confidence facing people and talking about their stories. Because in their mind, people would judge them. In their mind, people will look at them and say, oh, the connotation of asylum seekers or refugees, or is somebody coming to beg, is less than a human being, is somebody who's not qualified, is somebody who can do nothing for himself. Yes, they have been traumatized. Yes, they've been through a lot. But let me tell you, they are the most resilient people you will never meet. They have that tenacity of hope, because what guides their steps, what guides their journey, is the hope that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. But when a human being has nothing to die for, that human being is not worth living. They have something to die for. I've been in many horrible zones. I can see why people want to leave their country. But for people like other journalists who have not seen that, it's difficult to make them see what I see if I continue to abuse or to challenge them. I have to bring them around the table having chat with them and to explain to them, and also encouraging them to travel and to see things. It's only when you see through people's eyes, it's only when you step in people's shoes that you can understand what really people do feel and what really do people think.
Thank you, Almami. I think we should allow some time for questions. Loads of issues that the speakers raised there. I'm sure you all have questions. Should we maybe take three at a time and then... Yeah, do you want to start?
My question is that it seems to me there's an onus on journalists to give a balanced view. And it seems that to me that very often articles about refugees, in order to give a balanced view, they go to an organisation which is very hostile to refugees in order to get their opinion. And often these organisations are very extreme. And it seems to me that that does skewer the argument quite frequently. And I'm curious about it because, you know, if there's a racist attack on someone, we don't go and get a view from the BNP about that racist attack. But if there's an article about refugees, we very often get a very skewed view. And I just wonder why journalists do that, and is there a way that they can be persuaded from going for those extreme views?
Can I just ask, have you got any sort of specific examples of like organisations they might go to
that are anti-refugee? Migration Watch bodies, some of which are various
Migration Watch, races. I think is one.
Right, okay.
And come up with spurious statistics that we know are spurious, right, and inaccurate, and yet they're constantly asked.
I myself is a refugee, and I spent 1 year in a camp in Netherlands. And I was, like you are fortunate, I don't know, I was there in 2014 when the big wave of refugees came there. And when the picture of that little boy came on the shore of Turkey, everything changed. People, we were relieving, they were coming in the camp to see, okay, how we want to meet refugees. They came and they want to meet, and they organized a organize like open day for the you come and see the refugee how they look like come. And we were okay, come see, we are humans. And suddenly the clone incident happened. And everything becomes like 9/11 against refugee. Everything changed. And I my specific question, the big names, the relevant names of BBC and CNN, people think what they are telling is true. They believe that. And being a journalist, how you feel, how you can make any kind of strategy to raise your voice, what is actually is happening and what they are showing?
Yes, go ahead.
I am Nafi Saman from India, from South Asian University. Though I had jotted down many counter arguments, but because of the paucity of time, I am raising only a few. This is my inner feeling. I never witnessed any kind of a coverage of on television, whether it is BBC, I may be wrong, I am amenable to corrections. Media is not educating about the refugee rights sensitization. No such programs are there, number one. Number two, legal awareness is not at all imparted by any panel discussions, whatever is organized on different big channels. And role of judiciary, particularly if I give you an example of India, there are many judgments which have been delivered by the highest judicial establishment in India, Honorable Supreme Court of India, but I do not find any mention of those judgments in the media coverage, whether it is the Pakistani media, Afghan media, or Indian media. And at the same time, media is also having, you have rightly pointed out, and there is a commonality of all the discussions today, that there is a nexus between media and politicians, and role of media and media houses, they are even dictating the priorities of the governmental preferences in certain developing economies. So what is your take on these issues? Thank you.
Okay. Should we answer those and then take some more?
Is it right if I
go
for it? I was just interested in the point about journalists that go to slightly racist or anti-migrant organisations for responses. I would say I'm pretty certain that's just being lazy. I used to work 90-100 hour weeks as an editor of a magazine, and you have to sometimes do whatever is quickest. You have no time whatsoever. You simply type migrant into Google or whatever, and that's the first one that comes up. I think that I would say a lot of that is laziness. Obviously it depends on the slant of the actual outlet as to where they're going to go, because they know perfectly well if they go to this organisation they'll get slightly anti-migrant quote or, pro one. But I would say a lot of it comes down to laziness for that sort of thing, which is difficult to counteract.
Sorry, can I just come back?
Yeah, of course.
There's no code amongst journalists around vetting the types of organisations they might approach
I think as I was sort of saying, there is something about getting, it's seen as more legitimate to get a quote from certain well-known names. So as I was saying, Save the Children, Red Cross, other organisations tend to be quoted on Calais and Dunkirk, even though they're not actually there. And then, incorrect facts get into the media and are spread. Whereas the names of the actual organisations there are so much less known that that's seen as a less legitimate source, even though it's actually a more legitimate source. So, yeah, they would, it's laziness and going to the names that are most famous, if you like.
If you knew your subject and you knew enough to know that fact was spurious, you shouldn't print it even if they said it. Right, so that's the people, A, not having the expertise. So you have someone like Christy, who you ask her anything about the Turkish EU deal, and she can tell you because she's tracked it. And she's my source for it because I don't have time to track. She's like covers this stuff every day, and is completely on top of it and speaks to experts weekly. And I'm making that a bit up, but she just knows everything there is to know about this one subject. She specialises in migration, she's a migration editor, and that level of expertise is missing from many organisations. And that's one of the recommendations from that Norwegian report, is that people have specialist reporters and specialist editors on migration themes if they want to cover it properly. And I think part of it is laziness, but I think the other thing is a lack of resources and lack of money. that creates the lack of time. Because if you have to do something, because media organisations are stretched and they're trying to do the same amount or more with less and less people, and the quality just takes a nosedive as a result. Mm-hmm. So I think that's also going on.
They're also often reporting from their desk, just relying on phone calls. Mm. So they don't often go out and actually speak to the refugees themselves. It's easier to just phone and...
And they don't have the networks, right? Because they're not actually... That's when you meet people, when you're out in a place. Yeah. I would say that that's the easy tick boxes thing, to give it balance, well, on the one side and on the other side. But if you really want to write a proper article, you'd need some context in there as well. I think that's what often is missing from those sorts of articles and what you could demand.
One of the PCC, the Press Commission Complaints Guideline, is for journalists to avoid generalize on specific allegations likely to inspire hostility. Mm. There are things you can, like I said earlier, once the bullet is fired, the damage is done. So what you will get is apology from them. But the damage is already done. How to counter that is... also, organizations should be doing better, which means you could prepare the information, gather the people you need for the journalists to talk to, and contact journalists and saying, we have this. Because also we live in a kind of, the environment we live is a fast-paced environment, and they need to get the information so quickly. If you delay that, they will jump and try to get it otherwise. And we need to understand that fast-paced environments we're in and to do something up front to allow them, before even they ask you for the information is right there. And they know whom to contact and to do, to verify the sources and do like that. So there's as well a role we should be playing to allow that to happen in a positive way.
I think that's a fantastic point, actually. You know, if you asked for information or something by a journalist, you kind of have to prioritise that if you want your bit of information to be the bit that gets in. Because, you know, I can't even promise I will be able to... If you email me an hour later, I might not even get that in time in order for it to make the article or whatever. You know, there's not always time. There just isn't. So, you know, you have to prioritise kind of... giving journalists the information they require as quickly as possible, or they will just go to the next source because there just literally is not enough hours in the day. So yeah, it's a really good point.
And one of the other questions was about how do you counter the mainstream media, the big guys like BBC and CNN? I mean, IRIN is quite a niche publication, for example. I would say you know, do our best to provide, you know, some different sources and some different perspectives. But how many people in, you know, the mainstream even have heard of us? So it's tough. Any ideas?
I mean, it's certainly true that BBC is seen as truth in the UK. That's something that varies country by country as to what extent the mainstream media is accepted as truth or not. My personal perspective as a journalist is that one of the best ways I've found is actually to create individual one-on-one relationships with key BBC journalists, which, you know, that doesn't sound easy and it's not easy, but it's when you talk to an individual and connect with them on a human level and talk to them about what the truth is, that's when you actually start pricking their conscience. And that's sometimes what has to happen. Their conscience has to be pricked, to be saying, actually, I kind of know that's not true, therefore I'm not 100% capable of saying it, therefore I'm going to slightly tweak what I put out. I think because to fight, you know, the BBC as the source of truth in a sort of overall way is, I mean, that would just involve such a sea change that I can't do that. I don't know who could do that. So I think sometimes it's those little things that make a difference. I mean, I was... You know, as an example, and I think making the effort to contact them and correct them as well, as I did with Channel 4 a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. You know, I mean, and even last autumn I was in Calais and I had the BBC News 24 on my phone. And I saw them reporting that, you know, contrary to earlier reports, there is no fire in the Calais camp. And I was sort of sitting there you know, thinking it's a bit toasty right here, there's a massive fire right here, and I'm seeing it, and I'm watching and reporting, you know, that it's... But I made the effort to contact them and correct them on that and say, actually, it's right here. You know, I mean, they didn't do anything about it. BBC generally doesn't, you know, correct itself in that way. But I made the effort, and then they remembered my name, and then next time someone actually came to me to ask for a bit of information. So, you know, I know it's just yet more work, but sometimes you have to do
but
those
you're
bits
in a,
of work.
You're in an interesting position because you've been on both sides.
Yeah.
So I think that gives you a bit of a advantage there, knowing how to...
Just to add on to that, if you want to achieve what you want to achieve, you need to build the relationship, power in relationship. That's how you achieve things. Try to know about, to map the local journalists in your community, where you are. Try to know about those journalists. Try to have a link with those journalists. And you take a step further with all the journalists. Communication is power. A communication is something, you are in the middle of your living room or your bedroom, and the communication will find you there because you have the radio or you have to switch the television on. It is a powerful tool that you can use. So, but you use it wisely because it might backfire. It has as well that effect to backfire if you don't use it wisely. So be careful about it as well.
So make friends with journalists.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
I just wanted to share our experience. It's not a question, but it's more or less a comment. When there is an issue, and there is a hot topic about refugees and migration in general, or something drastic happens, you'll get the likes of Raggy Umar ringing you and others. And then when the refugee support sector is doing something like this that we're doing today, you don't see any gender. So I think what we're trying to do is the problem is in the refugee support sector as well, that we're dancing to their tune. They call us when they need us. But when we are having powerful discussions like today and yesterday, we don't tell them, or we don't put pressure on them to come over or be here, or even be on the panel or be in the audience, because that is where they can understand some of the challenges and issues, not that they ring us. And sometimes I think there's quite a lot of ignorance in them as well. So there are days when my phone rings and I pick it up. Can I speak to a Syrian woman with two children who is arriving and living with her family?
Yeah.
Goodness sake, no, there's no Syrians living with any family.
Sorry, who are you with?
The media.
I mean, but who are you, which organisation are you with?
The Coventry Refugee and Migrant.
Okay.
We work with 350 people a week, so there's quite a lot of people that we support. The problem is that it's just when you need it, you be contacted. But when we do things, so what we do in Coventry is when we have events like this, when we have conferences, when we have gatherings, I try to invite them. I send the invite first to the media because they need to be there on those days, not that when they need to speak to somebody that never exists in that category that they want to speak to.
And do they come?
Sometimes they do. What we've done is, initially we've started that relationship with local media. So instead of like national news, you'll get BBC Coventry and Warwickshire. So we've got very good close links. Next week, Saturday, we've got the Refugee Week event, Coventry Welcomes. The Coventry BBC will be there. So it's kind of like, making that they come to our conferences, our events, not that the only... They only call us. So it's that kind of like proactive relationship rather than whenever media contacts us, we'll speak to them. But we don't see them here. There should have been a report on something like this, but will they do it? No. But if there is an incident or there is an issue or a boat arriving, all of them will be there. So, and they will be ringing you as well and asking you whether you've dealt with anyone who's arrived on a boat to Britain.
I think part of that, though, you've got to remember, is driven by readership.
Yeah.
Readers don't want to read about a conference.
No.
They want to read about something exciting, you know. So that's possibly why there is less interest in covering.
Yeah.
you know.
There is still, yeah, I'm sure you won't get discerned to something like this, but at least there is a sympathetic journalist in The Guardian or others, or that at least they could. Sometimes what we do is we make it quite a little bit easier for them. So I've got journalist volunteers. They write a press release or an article on the event, and that goes there. Sometimes they publish it, sometimes they don't, sometimes they talk about it. So I think that kind of like giving me that kind of a nudge that this is also happening, although you're reporting on those, other things. But let's capture these discussions as well.
Sorry, can I ask, there's a Alexander Betts.
Yeah, Alex, sorry.
No, we get other people to handle first.
Okay. Well, you go ahead, Alex. You do loads of interviews all the time with the media, so I'm sure you have an interesting perspective on this.
I wanted to pick up on Hazel's point about the role that academics and evidence can play in media. And I sort of have a sense of frustration that everyone at this conference, I suppose, like me, belongs to a sort of relatively liberal, thoughtful, pro-immigration, pro-refugee bubble. And that's one position at the end of the spectrum in British public opinion and European public opinion. And at the opposite end of the spectrum, you've got a fairly nasty, fairly right-wing perspective supported by migration policy. And then you've got the majority of the British public in the middle, confused, don't necessarily know what to think. Looking at people like me and saying, when I comment in the media, that's a left-wing commentator with a perspective. Looking at publications that I love, like Hearing New Internationalists, saying, that's the left of the spectrum. Yeah. And they don't know what to think. They don't know where to go for evidence. What can we do to engage that, if you like, median voter part of the population? People who will read the Mail, will read the Telegraph, will watch the BBC, will be influenced by that. But when I speak to those people, they want evidence. They don't know who's credible. So what kind of evidence, what kind of fact-based can we offer the middle of the debate?
That's a good question. I struggle with this myself because I also feel sometimes like with Erin, kind of preaching to the converted, you know, you're in your social media bubble as well, you're talking to people on Twitter, but it's people who are ear and readers, we're not always reaching the people in the middle, like you say. I mean, I'll hand over to you guys, what do you think of the some answers to that?
Yeah, to reach people, to reach out to people in the middle, I think there are different strategies you could use. One of them is to organize public debates with peoples and then have refugees themselves around the tables and be really open enough to face the barrage of questions and being honest enough to respond to any questions they might face. That's one thing. To give you another example, what other things I realized after doing that job, media watchdog, filing a lot of complaints to PCC and so on, and I realized this would never work. It's kind of apologies, but the damage is already done. I set up different things. I set up a talk group with refugees and asylum seekers, and to go to universities, college, primary schools, and so on, and doing public debate and sharing their experience and questions from the public. And then you need to touch different, because people are interested in different things. Some people are interested in theater, in arts, in music, and things like that. And the best thing is to create that ambience, that environment, that the people would feel much more comfortable in and would be interested in joining you. We set up as well a theater group, for refugee backgrounds and asylum seekers. Right now we have a big, massive project going on with the Birmingham Rep, funded by the European Union. And my theatre group and the Birmingham Rep and Madrid Theatre Group will be starting a massive project very soon, and we'll be making that a film and touring Europe and to raise awareness about these things and to reach different audiences. That's another thing. Secondly, I do believe that if definitely, and I actually challenge people here to reach, to meet that challenge. If we decide from this conference that to show you a little things that might change definitely Daily Mail and Daily Express perceptions, writings about asylum seekers and refugees, if we decide from this conference that in 3 months' time we will have hundreds of asylum seekers and refugees with the community, with a bunch of flowers and bananas and apples and oranges and cake, and we go to Daily Mail and telling them, okay, these are presents for you. Thank you for trying to make our life difficult, but also this is for you. And if you dare inviting us into your issue and ask, interview us to understand really what you're going through because of you, we would be more grateful. And you will see, they won't tell you to go away because you will attract all the journalists. We need to displace the debate. We need, the Daily Mail will not come to you, the BNP will not come to you, but we can go to them. So, and we can go to them in a kind of a loving, caring way to show them we are not responding attack to your attack, but we are coming to show you love and to show you care because you want you to understand the damage you're doing to us by talking to us. We can do that, and we will see in 3 months if you accept to do that. Tell me after the 3 months if you have changed your perception, their perception on it.
You wanted to make a point here?
Just a quick answer to that. When I lived, there was a correspondent in Madrid, and there was quite a right-wing economic think tank that used to do these breakfasts for journalists, and all the foreign correspondents would go to them because you'd been invited to something, and people were going to talk about the economy, and that was what you had to write about all the time. And then, even though you didn't even share their political perspective, because they spoke English, because they, you know, you met them, give you breakfast, you tended to win them, you know, and you had to work much harder to like find your, like, the sort of perspective that you were after. So I'm sounding very balanced here, but anyway, look, but the other side of the argument, you know, that you might be interested in putting across in the same article, to balance theirs, you know, you had to work much harder to find it. But that's a question of resourcing. But, you know, invite people here for breakfast or go somewhere near them and invite them for breakfast. But you also do something slightly different. They're like, oh, okay, what have I got to lose? Mm. You're also assuming, though, that their editors will allow them to have a piece in that they think is balanced and that they don't have a political agenda that works to specifically exclude voices like yours because they're not interested in them. Mm. But I would also say take heart from the fact that when you write a piece for The Guardian or your material goes in progressive niche publications like ours, then you're actually equipping people with the arguments they need to win those discussions, you know, in their private life. But they don't say, this is just what I think because I'm a lefty liberal, I can prove it, you know, with these figures. I mean, you know,
with good journalism.
Can I just very briefly jump in on a fantastic point made about arts and culture and so on and the ways to reach the middle ground? You know, for example, we staged Hamlet in the Calais camp, and that meant it got a mention in the Telegraph arts and book section on the weekend. Yes. Perfect. You know, and for example, when we got Wi-Fi in the jungle, that got into the technology section. So there's ways and means of doing it, so sneaking the stories in. However, those things have to happen in the first place. You know, if there's no story to tell, then there's nothing I can do as a journalist. There has to be something that I can report on, that I can get in those places, if that makes sense.
May I just make a comment? So I work at the Oxford University Museum of the Ashmolean Natural History Museum of Digital Science. And I think we can say, so a lot of people come into the museum, hundreds of thousands of people. And I was going to ask whether there are roles with other organisations who have a public face. So we have public contact with all types of people, so whatever newspaper they read, they probably feel that they more children. So do we have a role? Do the museums have a role? Do other organisations have a role to have a platform, to have a balanced view and to put that balance view forward? Should we just rely on the media or should we be looking at other institutions as well?
Public events, kind of.
That have that public forum.
of it. Does that mean our time is up? The bell?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, I thought we had 15 more minutes. That's such a shame.
Can I make a comment here before that? I'm Dr. Ramsey, one of the representatives of the Muslim community in the United Kingdom, and working for one of the humble person working for the Sikh sanctuary. What I had, of course, reference to our friend, which he said, which I of course, in half an hour here, I didn't hear about that. And then I have a very, very good relation with the media. At any time which I say anything, they pick it up. Because the media want to see something interesting. The important thing is the news is not when a dog bites a man. The news is when a man bites a dog.
Yeah.
That you have what you have to do. You have to make it especially interesting.
Yeah.
If you make it interesting, the boring thing, because the people who read in it, they pay for it. It's not only in the television you pay for the thing, and if you want to buy the newspaper, you pay for it. The people are fed up of every 5 minutes, refugees. Mm. Make it interesting.
Yeah.
Turn it into a stick and dating.
Very good
and
point.
Again, instead of going to one, send it to 15, 16.
Yep.
Definitely one thing.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point.
Brilliant point. Yeah,
I think there's a lot of fatigue now after a year of so much coverage. There's only so many stories that people want to read, and so it has to be something different. And as an editor, this is something I face. I get story pitches every day, and I have to say no to a lot of them because I'm like, we've done that. We've done that story. We've done it before.
And equally, don't send a dry press release about a conference. You're no one wants to read that.
Yeah.
For example, pick out some individual that was there that has some brilliant story and say that they were speaking at this conference. Make it, you've got to find your own angles on these stories even before you send press releases to journalists.
Okay, I hope stories don't have to just appear in the paper. We've got some great platforms in the grassroots voluntary sector organisations and the academia as well. So, City of Sanctuary, local refugee support organisations, they all have websites, they all have social media presence, the Refugee Studies Centre, and I'm sure that there's quite a lot of platform where we can share stories. They don't have to always appear in the media, but either way, you can have an impact. So if you have a story, why don't we share it? I met Hazel yesterday, and I said, well, we do write quite a few stories. They're appearing on our website, why should I send them to Hazel as well?
Definitely.
And have one impact. So then making those kind of, that is what we would like to have out of conversations like this, and how we could have a better structure to share these positive stories, but also some of the stories around the impact of the asylum system on refugees through these platforms, that existing platforms we have in the voluntary sector.
Mm.
Because once we set up that kind of a structure where we constantly share these stories, the media will also find it interesting as well.
Mm.
I think, that's something we need to explore and see how we could bring some kind of I know we would be following what's going on in social media, but how do we make
that? Don't just send it to Hazel. You should have, ideally, everybody should have a mail list of hundreds, if not thousands, of press contacts, and you send your press release to them, But
can I just say as well, I've got cards, and if anyone wants to take one, we do publish a lot of our website. We'll put a lot of stuff on our website and a lot of activists.
If there's a story in it,
There has to be a story.
We'll publish it if we can, so please come after us. I've got loads of cards with me, and feel free to stay in touch.
Can we take one more question, or do we have to really?
Yeah,
quick question.
Comment on what Tara said, and Caroline as well, about empowering refugees and migrants. I like to use the word migrants because there's a lot of them around, and no one seems to really put a focus in economic migrants as well. Mm-hmm. What we're doing at the City of Sanctuary, actually, I'm part of the City of Sanctuary in Dublin, I'm part of the strategic direction, part of the steering committee. What we're doing is empowering migrants and refugees in Ireland. By giving media training. I'm a migrant myself. My mother was one, which is one of the reasons why I was quite passionate about this, because of what happened to my mother when she arrived in Ireland 16 years ago. So what we're doing is empowering ourselves. There are lots of young students who have graduated whose parents were migrants. They're very angry, and they want to do something. No one's talking to them. No one's engaging them.
Mm.
I set up a social enterprise in 2013 in Ireland. This was the only reason any students in Ireland knew that there were refugee centres in Ireland. No one knew anything. Every campus we went to nationally knew nothing about refugee centres existed in Ireland in 2013. So really, what needs to be done? I agree with Utah and Caroline as well. The power needs to be given to the migrants and to the refugees to represent themselves at debates, at press hearings, at press gatherings, at conferences. We've done this at the City of Sanctuary in Ireland, and it's working. We've done it in Waterford, we've done it in Dublin. Refugees are quite worried about stepping up into the public due to obviously pressure from the government in getting the documents. But they are migrants who are already nationalised, who can talk, who can speak for the refugees. So for the refugees who cannot speak up, there's a migrant to back it up behind. We have very strategic setup, and it's working very well for us. So what I would perhaps say is I would engage with the City of Sanctuary here in the UK and see how we can perhaps coordinate to see if we can spread this best practice that is working in the little island of Ireland into other places.
Thank you. Well, it was a really interesting discussion. I hope you all agree, and I'm sure we could carry on talking for a lot longer, but maybe we can continue.
Thanks, Ed.